Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Jamie Dimon's out $3 billion, which means somebody's a winner, right? $34.03 a share. That was the close on Facebook today. How you liking it now, everybody? And oh, for the simpler days of political advertising. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 21st of May. Good to have you with us. Facebook, face plant, face rip. I could go on, but it does seem unsporting, doesn't it? After the IPO failed to meet expectations Friday, shares of Facebook were off just shy of 11% today, $34.03 the close, as I said. That's just about $4 off the IPO price. Plenty of excuses, of course. It was priced wrong. Glitches on the NASDAQ Friday kept prices too low. Mark Zuckerberg should have worn a tie to Wall Street, you name it. It could be days before everything is sorted out, and the collateral damage is piling up, as Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports.
Rick Summers is an analyst at Morningstar. He says that with all the hype around Facebook, it seems to have become a leading indicator of all things consumer-oriented in tech.
This is the mother of all social networking companies. It really has defined what Silicon Valley is today around internet companies slash content companies with a social component to it.
With Facebook's stock diving, investors started to question other companies that went public in the last year or so. Earlier today, shares of LinkedIn and Groupon, which have little or no business with Facebook, took a dip, although they eventually bounced back. The biggest casualty was social gaming site Zynga, which draws a significant chunk of its revenue from Facebook.
And because of that, I think that there is a host of people or a host of firms that may blindly associate these two together and assume that they're highly correlated businesses.
Summers says that the number of Zynga's Facebook players probably hasn't changed radically since Friday, but some other fortunes clearly have. Michael Pachter is an analyst at Wedbush Securities. He says Morgan Stanley, the lead banker on the Facebook IPO, botched the deal by putting too many shares on the market. That spooked investors.
The idea that it's trading at 33 and 34 today tells you those original buyers are cutting their losses and getting out because they don't understand it.
But Pachter says that it would be a mistake to think that because Facebook's IPO is a failure, social networking is a failure. I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
There was an interesting development today in the globalization's here and we're getting used to it department. A huge Chinese movie theater company is about to become America's biggest theater chain as well. China's Dalian Wanda conglomerate is going to buy AMC Holdings and its 5,000 movie screens across the U.S. and Canada for about $2.5 billion. The Chinese and many others have tried to buy high-profile American companies before and have been met with resistance, probably, though, not this time, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
The U.S. has a huge trade imbalance with China. That means our dollars flow there, and China has to reinvest those dollars somewhere. So they're trying to buy American companies, says Penn State business professor Faribors Gadar.
That's what the Japanese did a while ago. That's what the Persian Gulf countries are doing with their excess cash.
In the 80s and 90s, the Japanese invested in Hollywood studios and Manhattan skyscrapers like Rockefeller Center. More recently, a government-owned company in Dubai tried to buy some big U.S. port operations.
If the industry is sensitive, whether it's ports or whether it's defense-related or it's telecom-related, et cetera, you begin to see some kind of concern, either from a national security point of view or, oh my God, the foreigners are coming buying this, that, and another.
But not this time. Gadar says a Chinese company owning 350 movie theaters in malls across America isn't likely to raise hackles. But is this a good investment?
Naturally, they hope to make money with AMC.
China trade expert Gary Huffbauer at the Peterson Institute.
The Chinese, in this case, are looking for technology acquisition. Well, that's a pretty fancy expression. But for learning how to run movie theaters for China,
where there is a growing middle class that will pay to sit in nice seats and see movies with state-of-the-art projectors and sound systems. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon was in the unwanted spotlight once again today at a big investor conference in New York. Because try though he might, Diamond still can't get past questions about the bank's $3 billion and counting trading loss from a week or so ago. He did say they're making progress reducing risk and they will, quote, wrestle this problem down. Those are his words. We've all heard volumes about the potential losses at J.P. Morgan, but what about the winners? Because somebody had to gain, right? Marketplace's Sally Herships has that story.
Let's just get right down to it. Where did the money go?
Clearly, there were people on the other side of those trades.
James Angel teaches finance at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business. The people he's referring to run trading desks at rival banks, hedge funds, and even other units inside J.P. Morgan. According to the New York Times, a mutual fund run out of a different part of the bank bet against the head office.
So it turns out that some of J.P. Morgan's own customers were actually making money off of J.P. Morgan's losses.
The whole market for complex financial products is murky. It's hard to know which hedge funds are involved because they're private and don't have to share their results. But one hedge fund did crack the door today. Bluecrest Capital Management said it took a small position against J.P. Morgan and stood to make money. But it didn't say how much. Ken Thomas is an independent bank analyst and economist in Miami. He says the final results aren't known yet, but it doesn't look good for J.P. Morgan.
This was the strongest of the strong. This is the biggest of the big.
Thomas says the hedge funds know they have an advantage.
And many of them are now actually doing better than they did before because Chase is in the uncomfortable position of having to unload this. And because everyone knows it, it's going to cost them more to get out of it.
Remember, it's not yet clear how bad J.P. Morgan's losses are. Many are still just on paper. Jamie Dimon says by the end of the year, he hopes there'll be no reason to even ask about this trading mishap. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Facebook, Schmacebook, the three major indices had a fine day today. Thank you very much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The NASDAQ glitch that stalled the Facebook IPO on Friday, that half-hour delay, is just the latest indicator that the markets, for all that we rely on them, are electronically temperamental. Millions can be made and lost in the milliseconds that it takes to execute a trade. That idea, actually, is the idea behind something known as high-frequency trading, using computers to place thousands of really short-term bets in the hopes of profiting from small changes in price. The practice was implicated in the flash crash of a couple of years ago, if you remember. Regulators don't like it very much at all. Commentator Dave Lauer saw firsthand how high-frequency trading can unsettle markets and his conscience.
Like many people in this country, I grew up in a world that equated success with money. I read Ayn Rand and subscribed to her idea that your worth to society is perfectly measured by the amount of money you earn. I followed the path of least resistance, and with degrees in computer science and finance, I wound up in high-frequency trading in 2009. I thought I was happy. While the economy was falling apart, I was getting rich, and so was everyone around me. Then last spring, the test came back positive. My wife was pregnant. Suddenly, I found myself thinking how I would explain my job to my future daughter. What exactly did I do to make so much money? What was I doing to add value to the world? After 2 years in high-frequency trading, I could see how little value it actually created. And I saw firsthand it was nowhere near enough to offset the damage it wrought, where computers create whipsaw volatility and fortunes are made and lost in milliseconds. I knew in my heart that I was nothing more than a leech, regardless of how impressive my trading algorithms were. The brain drain that sucked so many smart and talented people away from noble pursuits and into financial services to earn their fortunes made me question the very foundation of my economic assumptions. I decided to leave the industry and find a new path. My passion for startups had been with me my whole life. I found myself craving the challenge of creating something new and the rush of excitement when something you've built resonates with other people. I knew it would be difficult to quit my job in a terrible economic environment, start a new company, and have my first child. But in my heart, I knew it was what I wanted. When my daughter was old enough, I wanted to be proud to tell her what I've done, and even prouder to tell her that no matter what, she must follow her passion in life, like her father did.
Dave Lauer is a founding partner of the storytelling website Cowbird. Tell us what you think at our website. It's marketplace.org. Remember this the next time you hear anything about the labor market. It is, generally speaking, a lagging indicator. Tells you a lot about where the economy's been, somewhat less about where it's going. And within the labor market, there's a lag effect as well. Industries and occupations that have job openings today might not have those same openings in a couple of years. Exhibit A for us today is the professional pharmacist. Just 5 years ago, a pharmacy degree was a near guarantee of permanent and well-paid employment. So much so that a lot of universities started their own schools of pharmacy. In Tennessee, they went from one pharmacy school to a half a dozen of them. So you know what happens next. It's called the law of supply and demand. Blake Farmer reports from WPLN in Nashville.
This is Floxton.
An automated pill counter pumps out 100 blue capsules at Belmont University. It's one of three private colleges in Tennessee graduating their first pharmacist this year. The campus facilities are state-of-the-art, but the real attractions for incoming students were signing bonuses and six-figure salaries. Benson Chong says he's finding neither.
There aren't many jobs for us, like, just popping out at us.
Chong says he's about to graduate without firm prospects.
You know, I really wanted to go back home to Chicago. However, you know, I've heard that people are driving, you know, 2 to 3 hours out.
Rural areas still need pharmacists, but cities have gotten crowded. Chong wants to avoid the long commute and get a job in his hometown.
So, yeah, I'm just hoping.
Universities say the problem is baby boomers aren't retiring, but colleges are steaming ahead with plans to educate the next generation of druggists.
Even the accreditors were concerned.
Phil Johnston is the pharmacy dean at Belmont. He admits the agencies that oversee coursework worried there might not be enough local drugstores and hospitals to support so many schools. Pharmacists have also been concerned that a glut of graduates may undercut their pay.
I've been approached by those practitioners. Friends, colleagues said, you know, why are you starting this new program?
There's prestige in offering a doctoral degree and, perhaps more importantly, revenue. For-profit schools have launched some of the country's newest programs. Johnston says Belmont, which is a nonprofit, just saw a need and moved to fill it. But 2 miles down the street, so did another Christian college.
These are just some quick things that may come up. Metronidazole is definitely...
Fourth-year students at Lipscomb University are now prepping for their big licensing test. Many in the school's inaugural class have found jobs as the quintessential community pharmacist, but Kayleen Daly looked all over the Southeast and decided to hold off for now. She's opting for a year-long residency.
Because of the amount of pharmacists that are coming out, it's best to have that extra year of clinical experience under your belt.
I do have a couple of leads.
John Deason says he'll be relieved when one becomes a concrete job offer. He has big-time student loans that he can only put off for so long.
Deferred payments or, I mean, if you have to get on an income-based repayment, you can do that too. So, I mean, it's not like they're going to throw me in prison or something like that.
The pharmacy industry realizes it's hard for students like Deason to find jobs. The American Society of Health System Pharmacists recently authored a report. It's titled Expansion of Pharmacy Education, Time for Reconsideration. Douglas Schegelhoff is a vice president of the pharmacist group.
When you almost double the number of graduates over the course of 8 to 10 years, over time, that a doubling of the number of graduates is going to have an impact.
Besides not having enough jobs for everyone, the report suggests the quality of pharmacists could also suffer.
We're here today to establish a new tradition for the college.
Lipscomb's pharmacy dean speaks over a sea of soon-to-be graduates. He hopes to start a tradition of 100% placement. He assures the students they can find jobs in pharmacy, but instead of taking their pick, many may be forced to take what they can get. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
Coming up,
it's really fun to see how selling the presidency has changed over time and in some ways how it stayed the same.
Campaign ads with some perspective. But first, let's do the numbers. Wait, what's that music? Oh, wait, it's the happy music. Go figure that one out. The Dow Industrials added 135 points today. That's 1%, finished at 12,504. The NASDAQ popped up 68 points, nearly 2.5%, wrapped up at 2,847. The S&P 500 gained 20 points, 1.6%, 1315 the number. Facebook deleted 11%, as we mentioned, pulled Zynga down with it for a loss of 1%. LinkedIn dropped 2% today. Other tech stocks actually unaffected. Groupon clicked up 7%. Apple up 6%. Pandora up 3% today. JPMorgan Chase dropped another 3%, still reeling from those bad trades we were talking about earlier. Bank of America cashed out 2.7% today. Morgan Stanley off 1%. Citigroup and Goldman Sachs each gained about 1% today. The home improvement chain Lowe's sawed off 10% after lowering its yearly forecast. Home Depot added 1.2%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The National Association of Realtors will release existing home sales for April. The Small Business Administration continues their week-long conference as part of National Small Business Week. And tomorrow marks the one-year anniversary of the Joplin tornadoes. I'm Desiree Peña.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. There was a story in the New York Times this weekend that caught our eye. It was about essentially data. Last week, Republicans in the House of Representatives voted to get rid of something called the American Community Survey. It's done by the Census Bureau every year. A sampling of households are asked about everything from how local schools are doing to the number of flush toilets in the average home. Data, like I said. It helps government planners figure out where to spend money, so they like it. But there is another group trying to keep the survey alive, too, as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports from Washington.
Did you know that 2.8% of Americans walk to work? Or that the median number of rooms in an American home is 5.5? That's from the 2010 American Community Survey of 3 million random households. The survey asks each household member nearly 50 questions, revealing occupations, languages spoken, and number of refrigerators, all without identifying individuals. The data give governments and businesses an important annual snapshot of the economy, according to Maureen Haver, who runs Haver Analytics.
A store like Target will use the American Community Survey to figure out where to place their stores.
Transportation officials get warnings when growing housing developments will cause traffic congestion. Grocery stores know where to stock Asian vegetables. Without that information, Haver says it'd be a guessing game.
You might call it blind blind.
Budget cutters would rather see a voluntary survey, but Kenneth Pruitt says that's not good enough. He helped start the survey when he was director of the 2000 census.
If the census is underfunded and it is voluntary, data quality will go down. You'll just have higher error terms when you're trying to decide where to put that veterans hospital or where to put that bilingual teacher.
Pruitt says if participation wasn't mandatory, fewer Americans would fill out the questionnaires, and then census takers would have to knock on doors to find the answers, and costs would go even higher. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
There's a big meeting in Europe later this week. I'd tell you what it's about, but you already know, right? The economy over there, how to get it going again. Until that happens, the big worry in Europe is the banks. A run on them, to be specific. That would be a very bad thing. There were rumblings of one last week in Greece. It didn't actually happen, but if it did, deposit insurance, the way we know it, wouldn't be much of a backstop, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from the European desk.
The Europeans do have deposit protection, much like the FDIC provides in the States. They can put their money in the bank safe in the knowledge that it's guaranteed by government-backed insurance. But that's not entirely reassuring in the Eurozone, says Geoffrey Wood of Cass Business School.
A lot of these governments are bust. In Greece, that government couldn't pay. I doubt very much if the Portuguese could pay and the Spanish would struggle.
Depositors in Greece have been cashing in their accounts not because they fear their bank will blow up. Alex Potter of the Berenberg Bank in London says they're worried that Greece will be expelled from the eurozone.
The likelihood would be that the Greek government would forcibly convert euros held within banks to presumably back to the drachma, and that currency will probably then devalue further from there.
Better then to get your cash out of that Greek bank now, out of the country or even under the mattress before it's transformed into lowly drachmas. The only deposit protection insurance against that would be a pan-European guarantee of all eurozone bank accounts, with a potentially huge payout if things went wrong.
So this isn't, as the FDIC works, the issue of sort of isolated small banks going bust and having to bail out small amounts of money on an ongoing basis. This would be one gigantic hit very early on.
A pan-European deposit protection scheme would need to be approved primarily by the country which would foot most of the bill, Germany. Any signs that the Germans could be up for it?
I've yet to see a pig flying past my window. You might have.
In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The Romney and Obama campaigns are pretty much in flat-out general election mode. Now, head-to-head, for all the marbles, with television attack ads providing the soundtrack. Back in simpler times, way simpler times to some degree, campaigning was quieter, not so much electronic as paper-based. Campaign posters were the political advertisements of choice, and the Library of Congress has put together a new compilation of some of those posters. It's called 200 Years of Election Art. Ralph Eubanks is the director of publishing at the Library of Congress. Mr. Eubanks, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Where did this idea come from to put all these posters together? Because I'll tell you, it's a great little read here. It's just fun, fun history.
The library does all of its publishing in cooperation with trade publishers, and Quirk Books approached us with the idea of doing a book of presidential campaign posters, and it was one of those things I thought we couldn't say no to. You know, it's really fun to go through them and see how all of these images and how selling the presidency has changed over time and in some ways how it stayed the same.
Well, right, exactly. Turn with me then, if you would, to 1868, the race between Ulysses Grant for the Republicans and somebody named Horatio Seymour for the Democrats, lost to history,
gosh.
Mr. Seymour was. This is the first one that I could find that has an explicitly economic theme. You've got Ulysses Grant and his vice president, Henry Wilson, standing in what looks like a wood shop or something under the working man's banner. Clearly, this is, we are the working men and we're going to fix this country after the Civil War.
Well, that's a theme that really does kind of permeate the book. If it's not the working man, it's the common man. Earlier, it was using the symbol of a log cabin.
Right, of course,
and
with Abraham Lincoln.
The other one that I think is really interesting is the one of James Garfield in the field separating the wheat from the chaff and looking at those huge arms of his.
Oh, yeah. It's the 1880 race. And I should say we've got pictures of some of these on our website. It's marketplace.org. But it's Garfield, as you said, in the fields with a scythe. And he is nothing but heroic looking in this thing.
Very buff.
Very buff. Yeah, incredibly buff. It's very I am one of you.
That's very much the point of that poster, I think, is showing how he wasn't beyond getting out in the fields and doing some real work.
Which is actually funny because that's the last thing you think of presidents today doing.
That is indeed the last thing that you think about. And yet, I think even going up to the 1968 Nixon poster, towering in the background is Wilt Chamberlain.
Right. Go figure that one out.
And he's saying, I'm a common man,
right,
and I like watching basketball just like every other guy does.
So here's the this is the shoot this interview in the foot question. Why are we talking about campaign posters today, right? Because with Twitter and social media and television and YouTube and the web, there are posters, but do they have the same impact?
The idea of the campaign poster was to present an idealized image of the candidate. That changed when television came into the picture. I mean, if you look at the poster of Kennedy in 1960 and Johnson in 64, they're almost identical.
Right, exactly.
Television was playing a much bigger role. It was more of
I guess it was really kind of branding of the candidate rather than a real message. I don't think you see a really good campaign poster again until 2008.
Right, and that, of course, is the Hope poster. It's Obama and Shepard Fairey. It wasn't even done by the campaign. It's this guy who took this AP picture and turned it into what has become really sort of iconic, actually, for the 2008 election.
It is the perfect campaign poster. It takes an image of the candidate, idealizes the candidate, and then places an idea about that candidate in one word into the public's mind.
Ralph Eubanks is the director of publishing at the Library of Congress. The book is called Presidential Campaign Posters. You can see some of them on our website. It's marketplace.org. Mr. Eubanks, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks very much for having me here.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which we learn, not for the first time, that those baggage fees really add up. From the Associated Press today comes this number, $3.36 billion. That, according to the Bureau of Transportation Statistics, is how much we collectively paid in checked and carry-on bag fees last year. It is, believe it or not, down from 2010. Airfares last year, by the way, up 10% from a year earlier. Go figure that one out. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow added 135 points. That is 1%. The NASDAQ popped up 68 points, nearly 2.5%. The S&P 500 gained 20 points. That is 1.6%. Our producers include Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, Fiona Ng, Jolie Podokis, and John Ketchum. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us again tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.